to call the pre-council meeting to order. We have two topics. First topic is police report on accidents. Mr. Manager?
So we have two items. I think what we'll do is take about 20 minutes on each and leave 10 minutes for Q&A, and that'll be the strategy anyway. And Chief, if you'll lead us off with the police report on accidents.
Thank you, Mayor, Council, Mr. Mathis. I put in your packet, you have the report that we've provided you on minor accidents. I want to give you a little history on how we got to this point. Shortly after I arrived here, I recognized that we were working all accidents, regardless of the amount of damage, regardless of whether people were injured or not. And I saw it as a way to save some pretty significant manpower. It is pretty common across the United States now for police departments to not work accidents that are very minor in damage or where there are no injuries. And the reason for it is that minor accidents, accidents anyway, are basically a civil matter between the two parties. And insurance companies decide the percentage of fault and determine who's going to pay for what after the fact. And it is very, very seldom that an officer ever witnesses an accident. All the officer is doing is arriving at the scene of an accident and kind of trying to decide if there's witnesses or other people that are available there to find out what happened and then record that information. It is going to end up in the hands of the insurance company either way. We are still working accidents where the damage to the vehicles is severe enough where they cannot be driven away, so, or if anybody is claiming injury. And that's if they say, I lost a fingernail. If they're injured, we work the wreck. So we've reduced the number of accidents, as you can see in the report, by a pretty significant margin. Lost that little spreadsheet, but you have it. And you'll see that, by my estimation, we're saving the work of three police officers by not working these minor accidents. They're very, very time-consuming, and it is, as I said, just a service that police departments have historically provided, but they're moving away from. We actually made the change about 2.5 years ago, and this is the first complaint we've ever had, is the complaint that brought it to your attention. People seem to understand that if it's minor in nature and their insurance companies are going to work it out, and that's the way it goes. But in response to your questions, I did a Benchmark Cities response. We joined a group of Benchmark Cities this past year, and I asked all of them what they were doing. And you'll see in the report that we're right there in the middle. There are departments that are still doing them, but there are a lot of departments that are no longer doing them, and so we're right in the middle. My recommendation based on the, and let me say, we'll do whatever you tell us to do. If you want us to work them, that's fine with me. But I want you to understand that it is of very little significance in the overall scheme of things, and I realize it's tough when somebody has a wreck, but it's a matter between the two insurance companies. Some questions have come up about MoDOT. When we first decided to do this, MoDOT came up from Jefferson City, and we sat down around a table, and I told them that we weren't going to work these minor accidents. Their only concern at the time was that they be counted, which they still are. We can still provide them with a number that there was a minor accident, but it didn't meet the criteria for us to work the wreck. And as I said a little bit earlier, we're working everything that would be considered serious, significant damage to your car, or hit and run, or somebody was claiming injury. Give you an example. I rode on patrol today. We worked an accident. We were out on the scene more than an hour. And the officer is going to have to probably put 1.5 to 2 hours more into that accident before going home this evening. So they're very, very time-consuming. And this was just a simple rear-end wreck where you had a couple of injuries. So I've asked Sergeant Jill Schlute to come here. She's obviously worked wrecks in Missouri where I have not, so I didn't know where your questions might come from. So open it up for questions. Yes, sir.
I have one question. What's your typical number of officers that respond to an accident, or how do you decide how many respond and how many stay?
Okay. It varies. It's going to depend on the location of the accident, what kind of traffic issues it's causing. Sometimes it's in a place where you've got traffic backed up, so you would send additional officers to have to work the traffic. But the kind of wrecks we're talking about are generally not that type. The fire department, for instance, in that one today, had the lane blocked off for us and the ambulance, so we didn't require any additional traffic response. So this officer and I worked the wreck. But if you had a major one where there's a lot of vehicle damage and things scattered all over the road, you might have to have other officers. So it just varies by the wreck.
A couple questions I have. Whenever you have injuries, you do have questions of fault. Now you have a civil issue that one person's word against another, even as to where the cars were, I would assume.
The injury accidents, we're working. So if there's an injury, work it. Yeah. The only ones we're not is if the vehicle cannot be driven away by the driver. And I'm not talking about with one wheel flipping around. I mean, if it can't be driven away normally, we work the wreck.
Let me ask you a question along those lines. Let's say that I'm rear-ended by somebody and they don't have any insurance.
We would respond to the scene. We're coming to the scene on all these wrecks. We would investigate the fact that they could not provide proof of liability insurance and they could be cited for it. And it would be cited.
When you say not working them, you still are coming to the scene?
Yes.
Oh, okay. That's what I didn't.
Yes.
I thought you were saying that you really weren't even showing up.
No. Anytime the police, my philosophy on 911 or calling for the police, if a citizen calls for a police officer, they're getting one.
Okay. So by not working them, you're not issuing a report.
Exactly.
So you're still going, if there's an impaired driver.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
That's what you're.
Oh, yes, sir.
And
any of those other factors additional are involved in it, we're going. We're going anyway.
Or about the 16-year-old who is being berated by some belligerent older person.
Sure.
And we're going sometimes to. Having a sympathetic authority figure there can be helpful. So you are showing up. And if it's just a minor, so somebody bumped me from behind, work it out, exchange your card, see you later.
Right. We would supervise the exchange of information, make sure
okay. You
had a valid
license.
So you're
still doing that?
Yes, sir. Valid insurance, all of those things. Let's say your insurance policy expired 15 days ago. You'd most likely get a summons for that. And so you would still have to show up in court. We would just not physically do the accident report,
okay.
Which is the time-consuming piece.
And then I guess you educate the drivers that they need to file an accident report online?
Absolutely. Actually, what they need to do is report to their insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we've proposed here as an option, if you want us to go that way, is to come up with what some cities call a short form. He's looking at me because he's had this experience
just
recently.
I was going to ask you a
question. But we're perfectly willing to do that. What we're trying to do is to keep from having to do all the diagramming and things that are so time-consuming on these relatively minor accidents. And it's not minor to the people that are involved, right, Mr. Kespel? I realize that. But, unless it's just the simplest of wreck, we're going to work the whole thing.
But the insurance company wants an accident report?
Actually,
of some sort.
Actually, they investigate it again all over again. It varies by insurance company. But they're going to investigate the whole thing, and they're going to determine, based on a percentage, who's going to pay for what. And they recognize that the officer's not a witness. All the officers saying, this is what I found when I got there. And an officer could still do that.
Well, I know that there are a lot of people that will grouse about this, and we've had complaints here in this room, but what I appreciate is that this is a time-saving technique so that you're able to put officers on the street where they're needed. So. Overall, I'm pleased with this because we've had officers available in the neighborhoods where we've needed them in the past, and so I'm inclined to be favorable about this whole approach of efficiency.
And like I said, we've been doing it for a couple of years already, so without any real negative effect.
I think a lot of us misunderstood. I had assumed that meant you just weren't going to come. Work it out.
That doesn't ever work.
Okay.
So you do have a short form you're using now?
Well, that's what I said. We can put one together. That was one of our recommendations, is that we'll put a short form together that, in essence, is an accident report. You can call it an accident report. and if that makes people happier, we'll do that.
Well, I think you would have no question that it would make the people involved in the accident feel much better to have something from the officer rather than they left it up to me.
Right.
Now, there are some accidents where there are questions of fact, right? That he ran a red green light. No, I ran a green light, a red light.
Right.
I mean,
and really,
you can't adjudicate that anyway.
I had a fender bender a couple of years ago, and I found this process to work very well. The officer came, we exchanged insurance information, and then we settled it out, and I was kind of pleased because I hadn't used my signal, so I was negligent. The person passing me right in front of my house on a residential street was reckless. We both could have been cited and showed up in court. There would have been incentive, since if that would have determined who was at fault, we both would have had incentive to take it to court, which would have cost not only police time but municipal court time. And instead, it settled out with the insurance company. They split it 50-50. It worked out pretty easily. I like the process as is. I mean, police power is the most awesome power of government, and we want to use it only when necessary and for the things that impact public safety. And I don't see that being an arbiter in minor accidents rises to that level. I think it's a good policy, and I would recommend we keep it as is.
Yeah. It's an opportunity for police officers to be a reassuring presence to people who are pretty upset. So I think it's a great marketing tool for the police department to have, you know, a steady presence show up.
Continue to do that.
And a non-threatening presence. So
while you're here, can you comment on the, I know you talked about one time having a limit on theft. If it's under a certain dollar amount, we would not.
Yes, sir. That's something we're kicking around, and I've got a question into my benchmark cities group. Something that is also trending across the United States is shoplifting offenses that are under a certain dollar amount. The reason we're going is because the person got caught and the merchant got their stuff back. So they're holding them for us, and we're coming and then spending two and a half hours on a $15 theft. What we would propose, or what I guess in my perfect world I would envision, would be giving those merchants the ability to report those crimes online, or we can respond and write a citation, but not go through that lengthy reporting process. Let the loss prevention folks in those individual stores do it. And, you know, that's something that we're just looking at. But it's very, very similar to this, in just trying to reduce the amount of paperwork that officers are having to do in support of some of these minor offenses. And we recognize that even though it's a $15 theft, it doesn't seem like a big deal to us, it's a big deal to that merchant.
Absolutely.
So we would meet them halfway and still give them a mechanism to make the report while trying to reduce the officer's workload.
The difference to me is a crime of accident and a crime by choice.
Yeah, they're very, very good.
Person who does the crime by choice needs to be punished in some fashion.
Very good distinction.
To keep them from doing it.
And we could still do that, still issue the citation and get them before a judge.
Right.
But they're still innocent until proven guilty
sure.
as well. So
sure. Sure.
That's the rub there.
But I know the merchants heard about it or read in the paper. I read in the paper about it.
Right.
I had several merchants talk to me about this. That they
really what is that ball guy doing?
Really have a hard time with it.
Yeah. Well, before I learned my lesson on this one. Before I do it, I'll make sure you're aware of what it is we're doing and kind of the guidelines, and then we'll.
It's especially tough in a grocery store when nothing in the store is valued at more than $30.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
true.
And occasionally they get belligerent.
Oh, sure, sure. And if they do, oh, that's the other thing there.
So,
they're being combative in any way. We're coming. And as I said before, if you ask for an officer, you're going to get one. What we're trying to work on is what that officer does once they get there. And if we can save them some work, we want to do that.
Yeah, and we appreciate that because we've asked you to do a lot more with not additional manpower.
Correct.
So what you're saying is you won't screen that call in 911 and they won't ask, is the theft less than $30?
No.
If they want an officer, they'll come.
The officer would have the discretion once they arrived and interpreted what it
meant. Should put their mind at ease.
Yeah. Any other questions? And Sergeant Slee is going to be very disappointed you didn't have any for her. So if you wanted to come up here and grill her.
And make up something.
Stepped up yet.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Sergeant.
The next subject is...
All right, next subject is the Mill Creek Substation Transmission Study, Option B. Ted?
Yeah, as Mike said, this is our Option B, but we wanted to kind of give you an update on where we were and go over, review some of the steps that we've been through on this. Real quickly, the pieces that we have here is the first, I'm going to try to quickly review the need to make sure that you guys are refreshed on why we're even here and kind of review the project history to date, and then I'm going to try to save most of the time so we can go over the output of the Option B open house, and then we'll end it up by going over where we see this project going from here. The need, as you guys remember, we need to increase the transmission import capability to our system. Most of our energy does come imported to our system that we use on an annual basis, and right now we need to be able to add a redundancy and import transmission capability to the west side of our system is where we're primarily needing this improvement at. The other thing that we need to accomplish with this project is to be able to add the ability to serve load to our system. As the community grows, we need to be able to add transformation and substation capability to be able to meet the load growth as it goes. On the transmission side of the house, the primary thing we need to do is make sure that with any single transmission outage, we do not cause overloads on any of our other transmission elements. That sounds intuitive, but oftentimes, depending on the time of the year and the nature of the system, that's not always easy thing to plan for. The other thing that's kind of a little above and beyond that is any two transmission outages cannot cause a cascading outage of our system. On the distribution need side of the house, we need to be able to withstand a single outage of any transformer element in our substation and still be able to serve load without outages. Well, what that means is any of our substations, we need to be able to take a transformer out for either maintenance or if there are a trip or anything happens to it and not have any outages occur because of that load serving capability that went out for us. Just to summarize these two issues that we have, if you look at the west side of our system, we need to add a redundant feed to what is termed as the Pershey Creek Black Line. That's our 161 feed on the west side of our system, and we need to be able to put a redundant feed into that substation. Right now, our system will have the possibility of overloading someday in the future upon outage of that black line on the west side of our system. The other thing, as you can see from our service territory lines, most of our load growth is to the south and the southwest, and we need to locate the ability to serve more load on the south side of our community. To review the projects where we've been on the substation activities, we started in January 2009 to identify some sites, and we ended up with acquisition of the Peachtree site in July of 2010. This map shows where that site is located, where that substation that we have is. So we've located the point to where we feel like the substation is located at. Now we need to try to make transmission connections to this facility. We're currently pursuing two options. The first option that we proposed was three 161 kV lines to serve this. After that, we've also put forth a two 69 kV connections and one 161 kV connection to accomplish connection of this substation to our system. Graphically, and this is not intended to be a route, this is just from a one-line diagram representation. This is what Option A does, is it connects three 161 lines that go from our Pershey Creek subs to the new sub, from our Grindstone sub to the new sub, and from a south to the McBain sub up to the new sub. So this is our Option A, which is the three 161 kV lines that we have put forth. The Option B to review is it's a different philosophy. What we're proposing to do with this one is put the proposed sub in our 69 kV loop. So what it does is it takes a 69 line from Hinkson to the new sub and from Grindstone to the new sub. So as you can see, it effectively inserts that into our 69 kV ring. And then for the 161 piece, we have shown a line going from the McBain sub kind of around the outside of our system up to the Pershey Creek sub. And that's our redundant 161 feed. So that's kind of the A and B projects described, just to let you know where we are on the history. Is on the transmissions for Option A, we had our open house in October, and we've given you a report in April of 2011 of what that open house resulted in and our preferred options for that one. We went out for open house in September of 2011, and here we are today to review at this, and also we have a report on the council agenda to review the options for Option B. So with that, I'll turn it over to the folks who will hopefully have time to review the Option B for the open house on this.
Like Tad had mentioned, we had had the last open house in September of last year. We had myself, as well as our transmission planner, Adam Shuttler, and our consultant, SEG Engineering, with both John Clayton and Steve Rodick with us, and they're here with us this evening to answer any specific questions that you might have. At the open house, we kind of broke out into four different pieces. The first part of the open house was truly that. We invited the public to come in and review some of our materials that we had. We had large posters of our routes for each one of the routes for option B displayed. We gave a presentation following that, followed that by a question and answer session, and then allowed again the public to go out and review any of the materials that we did still have up after the presentation was over. During that presentation, we reviewed the background of the project. We kind of reviewed the need that Tad had mentioned earlier for both the additional load growth serving capability in the southern portion of our electric service territory, as well as the redundant feed into the Perchy Creek substation for the reliability need on the 161 kV system. We reviewed the timeline of the project and where we had been to date. We also reviewed briefly what option A consisted of, just to remind folks that it was different than this option B. And we went over a detailed description of what option B actually was. In that, we detailed, kind of like Tad has mentioned, that option B utilizes our existing 69 kV system. Inserting the Mill Creek substation into the 69 kV system will require us to build two new shorter 69 kV lines that will go from our existing 69 kV line kind of in between Hinkson Creek and Grindstone substation to the new proposed Mill Creek substation. It will also, and that will be used to solve the load growth portion of the problem for we're having in the southern portion of our electric service territory. As well, we also highlighted the new our new route for a 161 kV transmission line that would run around the perimeter of the electric service territory to provide the redundant feed into the Perchy Creek substation. Kind of detailing the routes, option B to get from Grindstone to the proposed Mill Creek substation, we had two highlighted routes, a green route and a yellow route, as you can see here. They both take off of our existing 69 kV system and head over land towards the Mill Creek substation area. We tried to find as two diversified routes as much as possible. However, both the yellow and the green route do meet up at one portion and then head west directly into the Mill Creek substation. Similarly, coming back out of Mill Creek substation, heading towards Hinkson Creek substation, we tried to find two diversified routes heading out from that station, although they do meet up at one area to and then tie back into our existing 69 kV system. I would like to note that there's an area on here that's shown that has X's on it, kind of behind, that's Walmart right there. That portion of the 69 kV line, if this route or these routes were selected, could be removed. And then we also highlighted the 161 kV solution going around the west portion of town. There are two main routes, the red route and the green route, with some alternates known as the blue and the orange route. We highlighted all of these routes at the open house, and we also gathered public feedback from that open house. The primary concerns of the public are shown here in their ranking, as you can see. Proximity to residential was extremely high on their ranking, with costs being relatively low. The summary of the public value factors, again, health and human safety and proximity to homes and residences scores very, very high, with costs being low and impacts to commercial properties being lowest. What we did is we took all those values and use them as weighting factors in a decision matrix to allow us to analyze which of those lines or which of the line combinations would be most publicly acceptable. The public concerns were used to weight the decision matrix. The majority of the concerns score negatively in the matrix. Therefore, the most publicly acceptable routes are the ones that have the least negative scores. And with that, the decision matrix popped out a selection each for the Grindstone to Mill Creek, the Mill Creek to Hinkson Creek, and the McBain to Purchase Creek lines. And that's what's shown here on this drawing. The yellow line from the Grindstone to Mill Creek station was the most publicly acceptable route, and the purple line from the Mill Creek going back towards Hinkson Creek was also determined to be the most publicly acceptable route for the 69 kV portion. For the 161 kV portion, the combination of the red, blue, and green routes were determined to be the most publicly acceptable. And this is shows the impact of the residential. There are fewer residences along this route, and that's how it impacted, the selection matrix impacted the selection of the process. We had noticed this in this route here, and this is a good point to point out that staff had, if we were willing to go a little bit further west, we could come up with a route that was mostly contained or partially contained on city property. And here's where we'd like to introduce what we're going to be calling option B2. B2 could be constructed on land that's currently owned by the city. Approximately 34% of the length is would be currently or could be constructed on land that is currently owned by city. It wasn't originally identified data due to it from SEGA due to its excessive length. It is currently 22% longer than the current most publicly acceptable route in option B. Here is what it looks like. Basically, instead of having heading up north up of Howard Orchard Road, the line would continue to head west down Route K to the water treatment facility. It would then head northeast along property owned by the wastewater treatment facility back up towards Scott Boulevard and then intersect where the original proposed line was on Scott Boulevard going back into Purchase Creek.
For the next steps for this project, what we're doing here is we're going to certainly be updating the website with all the information that, that you guys have received, in addition to all the timeline tables and all the open house material that we've put together in the past. And then one of the future steps is we're going to be putting together the material for our final open house that we propose. This a final open house is we're hoping to have this done in fall of 2012 is the time frame that we're trying to put together for this. Make sure you guys understand our open house will be a combination of option A possibilities, and then there's going to be the option B possibilities. And option B actually has two 161 line routing choices with it. Ryan called it the B2. It's basically option B as 169 connection and two 161 type routing studies with it. Like I said, the 161 path to our west side of our territory came about because it kind of goes by the water treatment facility and then it follows city property up on the kind of the west side of our system over there. Our intention would be After the open house, then we would come back to our, the final update and the public hearing process in front of the city council, and our hope would be that we could be early in 2013 in front of you guys at a public hearing type forum to start making some decisions on this project. I think you guys have seen this timeline before, and I kind of wanted to update you on this. You know, we at a point we split this out into option A and the option B. When we go for our final interested party meetings in this fall, we're intending to put these two option B, option paths back together. So our final interested party is going to take everything into account, and it's going to be not the same type of route selection approach, but it's going to take into account the different routes that have come out of the route selection process itself. And this also shows the final public hearing in the winter, and we really are hoping to try to get to a point where we can start acquiring easements in summer 2013, fall. I think Ryan's going to talk real quickly about what he sees the focus for the next open house from the information.
And as Tad had mentioned, our focus is going to change from selecting a route to more of selecting which option is most publicly acceptable. We will run it through again a selection matrix criteria, but instead of highlighting different routes, it'll be option A versus option B versus option B2, and it'll be handled in much the same way as where we will have an interested house where we will gather feedback from the public. We'll then use that feedback to feed into the decision matrix, and from that decision matrix, it'll pop out which one of the options is most publicly acceptable.
At this meeting, we would certainly expect that we'll have some information that's specifically toward undergrounding, the cost and the sections, and so that's where we're going to start rolling out information on how much undergrounding is going to cost and what sections of the line could be, should be, and how much the cost would impact those. So we certainly expect that to be part of that open house for the final criteria, because we know that's going to be an issue going forward. There's just some of the sites that we'll be maintaining with this, and like I said, this is just an update to make sure you know, and we're going to be headed out to the open house forum here this fall again with our final interested parties meeting. We're going forward with this. So any questions about where we are on this project?
Can you back up to the B2 route? The green out there, is that city-owned land?
That's right.
That's what the green is? So there's nothing built there? It's all...
There are. That's where the wetland cells are.
And down at the McBain substation, what subdivision is that there?
That's the Cascades just to the north of it.
Wasn't there another substation to the east of McBain we were thinking about tying to?
No, there's one to the south and southeast. That's Boone, but that's way over by our grindstone. We're actually tied to that substation through our grindstone. That's our latest, our 161 line that we kind of transferred the problem into our system off of others was when we put the 161 line from the Boone to the grindstone. So now the problem's contained in our backyard, shall we say.
How can you bring up the one that shows the...
That one?
That one, right.
Okay. So this was the one that came out of our interested parties as the preferred route based upon the choices that were presented to the public. And like Ryan said, it was a conglomeration on the 161 side of going from the red to blue to the green.
Right. Trying to orient myself where I'm at here on this. So that goes actually east of Highway 63?
Perchy Creek Substation, if you start up at the northwest corner.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm talking about Hinkson Creek and Mill Creek.
Hinkson Creek is that substation is right off of Providence Road down in Reactor Field.
Oh, so that's Providence Road. It's not 60? Okay.
Right, that's right. Providence Road.
And then the Mill Creek Substation is just southwest of the intersection of Nifong in Providence.
Quite a portion of the line that's there that's showing, I think, in the orange is existing 69 infrastructure, and we're just tapping into the existing infrastructure, and that's what allows us to get rid of a small piece of the existing infrastructure there, because we're basically bypassing some of that.
So the tie to Grindstone Station is on Grindstone.
That's correct.
Parkway. How far south? What's the one that goes south and runs to the west? What street's that? Is that a street? Where you go to Mill Creek, from the corner right there, where you go to Mill Creek.
Now, is that the yellow or the combination of the yellow and the red?
The red.
It's State Farm Parkway?
Pardon me? State Farm Parkway?
Yeah, it goes south on State Farm Parkway, and then it hits
where?
And it heads west between the property line between between State Farm and there's several property owners to the north there, but... State Farm owns a piece of property just above the State Farm Parkway, and then there's an apartment complex, and
so it'd be between State Farm and Rockbridge Elementary School somewhere.
No, it's further north than that. Rockbridge Elementary is much further south down Providence Road.
Okay.
It's to the north of State Farm. We're basically on the northern edge of State Farm property when we go west.
Okay.
Is the city owned land on Perchy Creek, down by Perchy Creek? Because where, if you go back to option 2B, that one there, instead of bringing it across, can you take it up along Perchy Creek and come in from the west to that substation?
We can go to the north and pick up our existing 161 line. The thing we like about this is it isolates our 161 feeds out, so we don't withstand a single failure. If you put both lines on the same right of way, we could have both feeds taken down by whatever an event took one line down, and that kind of puts us in a more susceptible position to system failure. So that's why.
And in
addition to that, there's already 69 lines coming south out of Pershing Creek that follows this pathway all the way down till we get to...
To Chapel Hill.
Chapel Hill.
And that's what I guess when I'm going, where you've got it on the right side going up Scott Boulevard, if you went west of the current subdivisions.
Yeah, that's where our 161 line heads out of Pershing Creek right now, headed to the west.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you.
So for part of that, just coming south out of the substation, we would be sharing 69 and 161 lines together for a ways, and then 69 takes off to the east, and our line would continue south.
Is there any unanticipated or previously unanticipated cost or benefit to B2? You have more miles, and I'm going to guess in terms of the wire, that the risk of failure is a linear function of how many miles you're going. But would there perhaps be some originally unforeseen benefit of having a line there?
Well, it does.
Down the road when the city grows further west.
Either 161 path in option B would have some potential to locate a substation in that area because mm-hmm. it's kind of in a load service territory. The only thing that's different is this B2 or the most westwardly 161 line does run by our water treatment plant. So if we ever needed a facility or a substation located at that plant, this would kind of allow us to do that at a fairly high connection level.
Yeah, and that may be some...
But there is a cost.
Unanticipated benefit. Yeah, but there's a cost, and I guess the... cost of copper is per mile.
Yeah.
The other question I had, is there any reason not to tear down the towers behind the Walmart, either leave them for future benefit or redundancy, or simply to save the cost of not tearing them down?
We would probably take it down just because the cost of switching that line. I mean, you wouldn't want to keep it active because it would cause you problems.
And there's no benefit to leaving the tower for potential future use.
Right.
And I suppose you can sell the steel or whatever it's made of.
They're actually on a single frame wood pole structure. There's just a single wood pole.
Oh, really?
So what we would do is remove the top portion that carries the 69 kV line, but leave, we do have a 13.8 kV underbuild. We would allow that to stay. So it would basically only just contain a distribution circuit as opposed to a distribution and a sub-transmission circuit.
Got it.
The two areas you'll be asked about is the Cascades and on Scott Boulevard about undergrounding those near those neighborhoods.
Yeah.
That'll be a concern, I'm sure.
And like I said, I think we are intending to try to make undergrounding cost and location of a focus of the next round of open houses so people know the cost and know the location and get some sort of an idea of what's the important pieces to underground and which ones aren't, so we can start kind of giving you guys cost associated with the important pieces. I'm sure just immediately at the substation, we would probably expect to do a little bit of undergrounding just to get in and out of the substation itself, so the substation won't have lines going into it. They'll just kind of like pop up at roads around there. So the substation itself won't, you know, to the best that we can, we'll certainly be disguising that in the natural landscape that's around.
I don't see any reason to underground that on the west side until you get to the subdivisions.
Right.
Right.
Well, the subdivision owners, the folks that live here will have something to say.
But we do understand that
there's not much development right on the road.
Not much. And Route K does have distribution lines running up and down it right now. It's either ours or Boone Electric's.
Well, this is pretty admirable piece of work here to route the lines in a way that doesn't go near anybody that you're trying to serve, because of course the whole purpose of these lines is to serve the houses that don't want to have them nearby. So this is a remarkable piece of work that you've done to try to satisfy all the interests and make it technically feasible.
And can we see B again? How much longer is the line on B2?
22%. So as far as distance, I'm not sure if anybody has a mile distance they could assign to that increase.
And option B gives us about two-thirds of the capacity of option A for about the same price. Is that 20 years versus 30 years of capacity growth to be able to manage?
As a guess, and that's primarily due because our load serving center is being inserted into a 69 kV ring that does not have the same transfer capability. So, I mean, it solves our problem on the redundancy on the transmission side, but from the load serving side, it's going to have a shorter term. Now, we'll certainly one of the things we expect to do during our presentations in the future is give you an idea of what the cost is and what the timing horizon is and put some numbers to exactly what you're saying there.
But well, yeah. And I suppose even more importantly is if this doesn't solve the load factor problem, then there will have to be a solution for that, and things will only be more densely built and it'll be more difficult to do.
This certainly helps us on our load serving, and the question is for how long, and that's a picture we intend to paint for you as far as how long do you buy a solution to the problem for how much.
And I read an article in the Wall Street Journal that the jury, or maybe it was in Power and Light magazine, that the jury's out on whether it's actually cheaper to maintain underground lines. Supposedly you have less maintenance because you don't have to worry about trees and wind and so forth, but the article I read made it sound like there wasn't necessarily a clear cost savings, and therefore burying the lines wouldn't necessarily have a long-term savings benefit.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have an opinion about that or.
Well, just from the experience of underground that we do have, I mean, certain areas it benefits just from a reliability perspective, but at the same time, the trade-off is if you do have a failure, it's substantially more expensive to fix an underground line when mm-hmm. it does fail. So it may not happen as often, but when it does happen, you pay a lot more to do it. So
mm-hmm. And that would be the point of the article, that the jury's out. It's not definitively cheaper to bury the lines in terms of maintenance.
Yeah.
And it's certainly more expensive in terms of construction.
And they do get very expensive when you get into the high voltage capacities of the lines. When you get above 100 kV to transmission and 200 or 300 volt lines, they can be really expensive to underground, and the failures can be pretty catastrophic underground.
Mm-hmm. Have you had line sag problems in the heat this summer? Have the lines sagged significantly more than usual?
Well, typically, line sag is more due to overloading of the line than just the ambient temperature, because they always run at a certain
okay.
ambient temperature above ambient. Really, I think the only thing we've noticed is maybe some of our anchors mm-hmm. that hold the poles might be moving a little bit because the soil is shrinking and the line might be dropping a little bit, but we haven't really got evidence that that's actually what's happening. There's just been a couple cases we had that trucks have grabbed the phone lines and caused us problems on the poles, and we wonder if the dry soil is causing the anchors to move a little bit on us. But uh-huh. there have only been a couple incidents of that this summer, so
yeah, well, that's,
it's not a rash or anything.
Well, that's fortunate.
Any other questions? Any other questions about anything?
Well, I will just point out the future agendas. We've got coming back at September 4th our thinking to date on boards and commission changes. We're about a two-year process where we occasionally come back. We've done some more thinking. We've canvassed boards and commissions. And we're coming back with some rethink on that. So you can expect that in September. And then after that, TDD's Get About Funds and a Roll Cart Pilot Project Overview. That's all coming in September, October.
How do people sign up for the pilot?
Well, we're going to have that online, and we're taking names now, of course, and I would recommend anyone who really is has a lot of questions. There will be an opportunity to see for yourself and try it, and so we'll take calls and put your name down. So John Glasscock is taking all those calls, right?
Does it matter, John? We have those scattered all over town, or you want city blocks or subdivisions, or how do you want that?
You're going to use the roll carts on the existing trash trucks and just muscle them around?
And how long will a pilot last? Do you have a time frame?
I think we're thinking 3 months, 6 months.
Wow.
And if they sign up, then they can get the carts. The city will provide the cart for them.
Okay. And how many people do you want on the pilot?
About 100 in each ward might be a nice round number. So we'll come back with all the details and our best thinking about the pilot.
If there's nothing else, let's take a 10-minute break and start promptly set up.